felt a little bit like being at a cult meeting, the way people are really into Kinnisberg.
Welcome to Global Rhetorics. I'm Jose Quintero.
And I'm Colin Bjork. This is the podcast that aims to amplify the work and networks of rhetoricians around the globe.
Hey, Colin.
Hey, Jose.
What are we talking about today?
Well, today's episode offers a provocative question about what rhetoric has to offer the field of design.
Design? What do you mean by design?
You'll find out more soon, but for now, we're thinking of design broadly construed, from graphic design to information design to visual design.
So anything from data visualization to Gucci and IKEA?
That's it.
Okay, so where are we going to answer this question?
First, we travel to Pretoria, South Africa, then all the way up to Uppsala, Sweden, and then down to Ghent, Belgium, a town that you may remember.
Yeah, we met there a couple years ago over French fries, mussels, and beers, didn't we?
Indeed we did, and it was a terrific experience at the International Rhetoric Workshop there.
So who exactly are we interviewing?
You're about to find out.
Goedemorgen, Colin. My name is Annelie Bowie, and ek is 'n ontwerp en retoriek navorser in Suid-Afrika in Pretoria.
Was that Afrikaans?
Sure was. And here's her introduction in English.
Okay, I said, good morning, Colin. My name is Annelie Bowie. I'm a researcher in design and rhetoric in South Africa and Pretoria.
How do you spell that?
Annelie spells her name A-N-N-E-L-I-B-O-W-I-E.
We say Bowie. I know Americans say Bowie. Yeah,
no, that's yeah. We do. Yeah. We say Bowie. I guess the British also say David to give David Bowie.
You mean David Bowie?
Yep, I just mispronounced David Bowie's name.
Okay. I was very happy to become a Bowie, by the way. I was a Buddha before.
Okay, all right.
So where'd you meet Annelie?
I met Annelie at the 2019 Rhetoric Society of Europe conference in Ghent, Belgium.
We have that in common.
Yeah, that place is full of rhetoricians. And while I was there, I learned an interesting factoid.
Yeah, so the Afrikaans I just spoke is very similar to Flemish. I don't know if you knew that.
I didn't know that. What's
it's actually more similar, I think, than Dutch, which is what Afrikaans originally then sort of came from. So I think it's the mixture of French and Dutch, perhaps, that makes Flemish so similar to Afrikaans. Huh. But I can understand almost everything around me if people speak slowly enough. Yeah, so what I just spoke is very similar to the Flemish you'll hear around, yeah.
Incredible. Mm. I'm just going to have to go around with you and let you be my tour guide then here in Ghent.
So what came out of this Belgian tour?
Well, beyond the mussels and the frits, I wanted to learn more about the relationship between rhetoric and design.
I would say rhetoric features as an angle in almost everything I do. Rhetoric is obviously the sort of art of communication, and I think my discipline is called information design, but it's basically a synonym for visual communication design. So as long as you're communicating, I think rhetoric is always relevant.
Okay, I get that design is a form of communication, but what specifically about the field of rhetoric does Annelie find helpful?
That's a great question, and I think the best way to answer it is to let Annelie tell her story from the beginning.
So I started with a master's in information design when it was still a coursework master's, and there I was exposed to rhetoric for the first time. We had some reading to do on visual rhetoric specifically that was considered a fairly young and upcoming sort of theoretical angle in my discipline. And not knowing anything about rhetorical theory at all, it seemed logical to me to start with Aristotle as the father of rhetoric, I suppose. Not necessarily the most accessible, but sort of the most basic. A few design theorists have referred to Aristotle's basic sort of logos, pathos, and ethos as a framework for understanding visual design products. So that's where I started. Back then, I was really interested in information visualization and how rhetoric features in in how information is presented to us in a visual format. I think back then infographics were really popular. You know, there was yes. like a real sort of infographic boom. So that was what I was initially interested in, specifically the ethos of how these infographics either came across as authoritative or not. And along the debates that I saw in infographics and information visualization practice, I often noticed that people spoke about the propriety or the need for these graphics to be beautiful and whether that was a good thing or not. And I kind of felt like aesthetics and rhetoric were so intertwined in that regard. So if something looked a certain way, of course, it could come across as legitimate, or it could come across as a bit flaky. And that's where my master's study sort of led then, to look at intersections between how we understand design aesthetics and how that relates to rhetorical persuasion and information visualization.
So she's using rhetorical vocabulary to understand how aesthetics are persuasive.
That's right. But that's not the only way that rhetoric intersects with the field of design.
Tell me more.
Well, Annelie had a transformative experience at a Burke conference in Ghent, Belgium.
So then I was a full-time lecturer at the University of Pretoria then, and a colleague, Amanda de Pria, she saw a call for papers for a conference in Ghent in Belgium, on the first conference dedicated to the work of Kenneth Burke outside of the United States. And I had no idea who Kenneth Burke was. I'd never been to Belgium, but this seemed interesting to me. The theme of the conference was called Rhetoric as Equipment for Living. And it seemed like there was a lot to work with in the work of Kenneth Burke as I sort of initially explored it. So my colleague and good friend Duncan Rayburn and I, we decided to submit a paper to this conference and make a trip to Belgium together. And at this conference, in the same venue where we're sitting yeah. now again, a few years later, that's where I decided Kenneth Burke, his work is really interesting. I'm going to focus on that for my PhD. Yes, so that's how I ended up studying.
Wow, so the CFP yeah. just brought on this whole turn in your own research.
Yes, I'd never heard of Kenneth Burke, and I suppose for me that was already a sign that there was definitely a gap. I don't think anyone in my discipline was really that interested in Kenneth Burke's rhetoric specifically and how that could be useful for our discipline. So that was sort of the initial way in. But what I found really appealing during that conference was also just how broad the topics were that were related to Kenneth Burke's work. He struck me as quite an eclectic and sort of versatile theorist to also really get into, and I found that quite appealing as well. Yes, so being at that conference, it was a little bit strange. I don't know if your listeners would want to hear this or if it's strange to say.
Tell the story.
But
Tell the story.
It felt a little bit like being at a cult meeting, the way people are really into Kenneth Burke.
That's right.
But I thought there's got to be something here. You know, people love this guy.
Yeah.
So I was intrigued. And like I said, all of the sessions that I attended, I found them very, very divergent and quite interesting. So I felt like I could commit myself to this for 3 or 4 years potentially and see how that could relate to my own discipline.
Okay, so this conference became foundational to her work. But how central a figure is Burke for her now?
Ah, you can sense the shift coming, can't you? Here's a longer description of the multiple facets of her Burkean approach to design.
While I was studying Burke, and I suppose because he has such a strong emphasis on literature and understanding how people speak about things, my interest in design rhetoric did go in a bit of a different direction. I started initially with an interest in visual rhetoric specifically, as in how the look of something persuades us for whatever reason. And through Burke, and especially during my time in Uppsala in Sweden, which I'll get to, I became more interested in how designers speak about their work than in about just what they make, because I think how designers speak about what they make is so central also in what is accepted and what is produced. So just to give you an example, I think in design contexts, it very often there's more than one way to go about making something or what it should look like. But because there's a lot of variability, I think designers need to articulate their reasoning for a specific course of action quite effectively. So I think that part of design practice is very interesting, how designers justify their moves to clients, to their colleagues, how my design students would have to justify or rationalize their decisions when they sit in a crit session in the studio. Because I think there's a lot of leeway with regards to what something can actually look like, but designers need to be able to make good arguments or legitimate, they need to provide legitimate reasons for why they made something look a certain way. And once they can do that, then people are generally accepting. Yes, that makes sense. It makes sense for this product to look that way. I'm very interested in the arguments related to interface design trends, particularly how designers speak about what interfaces, whether they're mobile or other devices, what the interfaces look like. And fairly recently, I suppose it's not that recent anymore, there was a big shift in interface design aesthetics when everything went flat. I don't know if you noticed that.
No, tell me more about that.
Well, it happened around 2012, I suppose, when Microsoft came out with their new operating system. They called their new visual language Metro, and it was entirely different from everything else that was on the market. So before Metro, all of your icons were beautifully designed to look like real world objects, little bookcases or notebooks, or so these physical metaphors were highly detailed in how they were rendered. And Metro came along, that is Microsoft's Metro, and they created these flat blocks of color with flat icons. And this was considered a visual revolution. And a lot of the arguments around this revolution I found incredibly interesting. So again, I was almost more interested about the language that was used to describe the movement than the actual visuals themselves. So I noticed that the language used around the shift from very realistic icons and interfaces to this flat aesthetic was very similar to the kinds of language used in modernist design movements at the start of the 20th century, where ideas like material integrity, you know, how you had to be true to the medium in how you presented your design product. I found that so interesting because I don't think a digital medium necessarily has an authentic materiality that needs to be adhered to. So for me, the rhetoric about why this new aesthetic was considered so much more effective, so much more functional, so much more authentic or honest even, for me that was really fascinating. So yes, that I think that's a good example to show how design arguments then become very persuasive and how a massive movement then emerged from that point onwards where even Apple, that was considered the forerunners of very detailed imitative kinds of aesthetics, even they then changed, they updated their entire iOS visual language to reflect this flat trend. And I think that was largely because of the arguments used that really made those previous treatments seem backwards or even vulgar in how they were fake, you know. I think in visual art and design, of course, we have this history of valuing the avant-garde. We want whatever is new, whatever is innovative. It's very closely related to fashion, even though I think designers are reluctant to admit it. So it makes good design business sense, of course, to change aesthetic approaches, because you can sell more products. If you change the aesthetic of your product every few years, aesthetic obsolescence is a real moneymaker. But I think what makes the discursive strategy so interesting is the fact that they have to deflect away from this aspect of design as fashion. It doesn't go down well to say that we made this product look different just so that we could, you know, just so that we could create a new fashion. So I think the arguments in support of new design products or new approaches need to tap into more substantial kinds of motives or substantial reasons for why something needs to look different. It probably sounds quite cynical on my part to say that things only change because of fashion, but I think in some sectors that is the case, and I think that causes a lot of problems. As part of my PhD research, I was very interested in how aesthetic obsolescence and how discursive trend arguments exacerbate unsustainable design production. So through Kenneth Burke's theory, I was interested in how we could raise awareness or just develop broader perspectives, I suppose, on discursive design strategies by taking a long view at how these change over time. And in such a way, maybe designers can be less caught up by hype and trends and fads, in such a way that they can produce design products and sell those products with less sort of extreme and radical kinds of argumentation, to say it is different and it's great, but not necessarily that it's better per se, because I think that's where people start discarding what exists prematurely. So yes, I'm interested in how design approaches fluctuate over time, how those fluctuations are justified or motivated, how we could maybe rethink how we design things, but also very much how we speak about what we design, so that perhaps we can value products for longer.
More than rhetoric being used to understand persuasion in design, is she saying rhetoric's foundational to design?
Perhaps. And to clarify, this rich relationship between rhetoric and design requires turning to the history of the field of design itself.
Yeah, design as a discipline emerged in the Industrial Revolution with the mass production of things. Design is very intimately related to the mass production of things. Before that, we had craft. And if you look at South African design history, it's very much a history of craft because industry wasn't obviously as developed as it was elsewhere. It's difficult to draw the line exactly between what is craft and what is design, but I think design definitely has this very close relationship with mass production and all of the problems that go with that.
I love the distinction she draws between design and craft, even if it remains a fuzzy one.
It is a helpful dyad, and it's especially interesting in the context of South Africa.
In South Africa, it's a bit of a contentious issue, I suppose, at the moment with all the talk about decolonizing education, because to a large extent, design education in South Africa has absolutely been a Western, basically modernist design education that comes from Bauhaus roots, I suppose. So we are constantly thinking of ways that we can highlight the local design heritage that South Africa has to offer that has been very much neglected. But that's a work in progress for sure. All of our textbooks, all of our histories are sort of tied to trends and movements that were European or Western, really. So that'll take a while, I think. It really depends on where in the world you're also finding yourself. I think different countries and different regions would have different approaches to how they situate this discipline. I think in Europe there's a tendency to group architecture and design sort of in polytechnic kinds of faculties. And in that regard, my university and the information design subject that's offered there is a little bit different. It's part of the humanities faculty, the visual arts department that I was working at. And I think this is, in a way, a bit of a problem, but in another way, it's also great. I think the rest of the humanities don't always understand the sort of practical nature of the course and what that requires. But on the other hand, I think I'm very interested in other subjects in the humanities. So for me, being able to collaborate with colleagues more easily within the same faculty, that was great for me. So yes, I think it's just unusual to have a design department even part of a traditional university and then as part of a humanities faculty. I don't know what it's like in the US or in New Zealand, but I definitely found in Europe that's not how things are done. Generally, I found that art and design and craft and architecture tend to be quite separate from your traditional university.
So she knows about this distinction because she studied design both in South Africa and in Europe.
You got it. But in Europe, she shifted from working in a department of design to working primarily with rhetoricians.
In 2014, I just registered to start my PhD at the University of Pretoria in South Africa, where I was also a staff member, a lecturer. And shortly after I registered, my husband got a position in Sweden to go work in Stockholm. And so I frantically searched for a place for me to conduct my research on an exchange program. And I did contact some design faculties as well, but Uppsala University, then close to Stockholm, has a rhetoric division as part of their literature department. And they were very excited about my research and they welcomed me as a guest researcher there. So this was very lucky, I suppose, that my husband had this two-year work opportunity and I had this two-year exchange opportunity at the same time. So originally, it was a bit of a strange fit because the rhetoric division in Uppsala, at Uppsala University, is in the Swedish literature department. And I don't speak any Swedish, but for me, this was just such a fantastic fit in the sense that this was the first time that I was exposed to other scholars who were working on various aspects of rhetoric and not design or visual culture, which was my background. So I think this was a really enriching experience for me to be exposed to various kinds of research projects in rhetoric specifically. So as part of the exchange, then I was still quite early on in my research project, which I think was maybe not ideal in the normal sort of exchange agreement. But for me, this was actually really great because I was still grappling with exactly what my angle was going to be for my PhD. So I was able to do some coursework in rhetoric to familiarize myself with some of the more traditional rhetorical theories that Kenneth Burke often does also refer to or reflect back on. So that was very useful for me. I didn't have to teach any courses while I was there, but of course I was able to attend seminars and present my own work at various seminars. And for me, the whole culture of sharing ideas, the collegiality in general in Uppsala, I found really fantastic. In South Africa, in my discipline specifically, it's very unusual to work full-time on your PhD as well. We're pretty much full-time like I think they do in Uppsala. They do a little bit of teaching, but I think they really give it a lot of space and opportunity to pursue research. And for me, this was also a bit of an eye-opener, I suppose. In South Africa, you have a full-time teaching position and have to do your PhD sort of on top of that.
I'm glad she mentioned her teaching because I've been curious to know the role that rhetoric plays in her pedagogy.
Yeah, I got to ask her about a pedagogical paper that she wrote about her service learning course that she taught in conjunction with the South African prison system.
My colleague and I, Fatima Kassim, and I, we published this paper together after we taught this project together. It was a really challenging but exciting project where we really learned a lot throughout. every year the information design students participate in a design for development project. So this is coupled with the service learning sort of agenda of the university, I suppose. It's considered a very big part of what the University of Pretoria does. So the paper that we wrote was about a specific project that we taught a few years ago, where we collaborated with the Department of Social Work, where students were to work closely with inmates at a local correction facility in Pretoria. So as you can imagine, students were very nervous about having to go to a prison and having to speak to inmates there. I'd had quite a lot of experience with that sort of thing already because my mom was a psychologist at Correctional Services. So for me, this was quite exciting to go back there and to do a project there. So Fatima and I, we wrote the brief where we also then went on visits up front to the various facilities. And then students had an opportunity to basically go in and have conversations in small groups with inmates in the various facilities. And then they had to identify potential design problems that they could try and address through whatever skills they have gained in the last 4 years, which is a very tall order, actually, of fourth year students. But I think this was such an enriching experience for them as well. So they had a number of visits then where they went to the prisons, and then they had to create prototypes of various design products. A lot of them were sort of toolkit related educational products. Some of them were sort of more entertainment based, I suppose. But whatever they felt was lacking or needed, the brief was fairly open. So students then had to create these prototypes and then had to go back to test prototypes and sort of user test some of their solutions. But there were, of course, a lot of challenges and limitations in that process. Just the security, of course, having to get into the facilities was quite tricky. But we found that the most meaningful aspect of the project was actually just the interaction between students and inmates. And they had to write these reflection essays then as part of the project, where we could also then gauge, obviously, as lecturers, what the students gained from the project. So we were very interested in how students then also reflected on these values, how they perceived the project went. And a lot of the students struggled with ethical questions about the true reciprocity of their engagements there. Some of them felt almost a bit guilty, like they got more out of the project than they could actually deliver. And I don't know if that's entirely true. Perhaps their projects didn't sort of see the light of day in terms of products being produced in mass for prison services, you know. But I think their presence was also meaningful in some sort of way. But it was very interesting for us to see how students grappled with these questions of the impact that they could have or couldn't have because of the various limitations that the project just had by default, I suppose. And I think this was interesting for us on a broader level, how a lot of these service learning modules, you are confronted with these kinds of challenges where curriculum-based interventions are necessarily short-lived as part of a course, and you have a responsibility towards whoever it is that you're engaging with. After this prison project, we felt like we couldn't go back there because there were too many unanswered questions and there were many concerns about that reciprocity. Like I said, it was too difficult to really propose anything and to make any sort of meaningful change. And students didn't feel great about that. So after that, we changed the project slightly. After that, we focused on sort of wildlife and environmental education sectors, where we had students work more closely with children. And this was a lot more manageable from a service learning perspective, where you really wanted to get it right, where you wanted to have meaningful engagements with communities outside of the university, but in a way that was just going to be meaningful for everyone involved. So those projects were also really interesting then for the South African National Park Service, where students created educational toolkits on environmental education, where they also collaborated with fine arts students that created puppets and drama students that created puppet shows. So that was also a really interesting project going forward. Fatima and I suppose, we noticed the rhetoric in service learning discourse and human-centered design discourse, and how there were very similar kinds of discourses in both. And I suppose that was interesting to us. So our students were exposed to human-centered design discourse more so than service learning, because I suppose that's more from a faculty perspective, the kinds of things that they're aware of. But our students definitely were exposed to the human-centered design philosophy, human-centered design values, and that kind of language came through quite strongly then in how they reflected on their work. So there's definitely a very strong discursive aspect to what we do. If you have the vocabulary to speak about your process and your practice, I think it makes you think in different directions.
What a fascinating project. I love how rhetoric gives her and her students the vocabulary to better understand their conditions of experience. So now we've heard about her education and her research and her pedagogy. Colin, what is she up to now?
She's currently in a postdoctoral position at the University of Johannesburg, where she's researching the Fourth Industrial Revolution.
As far as I know, the idea of the Fourth Industrial Revolution really started in Germany, the 4IR. And the idea is that new technologies, artificial intelligence and automation technologies, blockchain and all sorts of other sort of connected technologies are changing the way that industry functions. So recently at a State of the Nation address, our president spoke very prominently about embracing the Fourth Industrial Revolution as well. And at the University of Johannesburg, which is where I'm going to be doing my postdoc, there's a big drive towards positioning projects in relation to this idea of the Fourth Industrial Revolution. So my project, I suppose, is a little bit different in the regard that I might take a slightly more critical stance on what this means globally as well as for South Africans. I think in South Africa, we have a lot of problems that are perhaps peripheral, that require attention. And in the media, we see that there is a lot of criticism directed at all of this hype about the Fourth Industrial Revolution. This State of the Nation address happened around the time where we had a lot of blackouts as part of our main electricity supplier that is underpowered. So it was quite ironic to speak about all of these new technologies and what they're going to mean for the South African economy when we don't have electricity. So the media was reporting on this, and there were a number of interesting cartoon strips in the newspapers as well, criticizing the so-called Fourth Industrial Revolution insofar as it won't happen if we don't have electricity. So I was once again interested in these discrepancies between the hype and the reality. But I'm also really interested in the potential of people coming together under a common cause, I suppose. Perhaps the rhetoric around the Fourth Industrial Revolution could be quite inspirational as well. So I won't just be critical about it. Mm-hmm. I'll try to look at the positive outcomes as well. Part of my study will be looking at the visual rhetoric of the Fourth Industrial Revolution as it is used in South Africa specifically. So the kinds of imagery that's used when communicating what it is, because of course it is a very abstract concept that a lot of people struggle to understand, like blockchain. What on earth is blockchain? How do you visualize it? How do you visualize artificial intelligence? And what I've noticed also is that there are certain visual tropes, certain images that are used recurringly in the communication of the Fourth Industrial Revolution. So I'm interested in that as a start. But I'm also interested in the discursive rhetorics as well. And then also in terms of how the South African media is responding to it, the kinds of satirical responses that I've seen in the newspapers are quite interesting as well. So I'll try to take a more holistic stance around the fourth industrial revolution and how that's communicated and what that means in South Africa.
It's really amazing the kind of work one is able to do after having such a varied research and pedagogic experience.
I agree. And now we've come to the final part of the interview. It's the question that we ask every guest on this podcast. When other rhetoricians come to visit you, what should they do in your city?
Pretoria, I think, is often skipped altogether when people visit South Africa. You land in Johannesburg and then you head off to Cape Town or the Kruger National Park or some other game reserve, I think. But I think there are a few places worth visiting in Pretoria. One of my favorites is the Groen Kloof Nature Reserve, where right in the middle of the city you can go on a hike and you can see zebra and giraffe and all sorts of other wildlife. So that's really fantastic. And then Pretoria, I think, is also interesting for seeing some of the historical shifts that we've seen in South Africa. So on the one hill, you'll have the Voortrekker Monument, which is a very big symbol of sort of Afrikaans, Boer, and also apartheid culture, I suppose. And then on the hill just opposite, you have the new Freedom Park, which was developed after the fall of apartheid. And I think the contrast is quite stark. So I think in Pretoria, you get that long view as well of how things have changed. It is also quite close to other game reserves and national parks if you wanted to have the real safari experience. So I think that's also something I'd recommend if someone were to visit South Africa. Is absolutely go on a safari, probably to the Pilansberg. It's a bit closer than the Kruger Park. And we have really fantastic restaurants and really fantastic wine,
ooh,
which people might not know. And it's very affordable to foreigners.
You heard it here first. Don't skip Pretoria.
Don't skip it.
This has been Global Rhetorics. I'm Jose Quintero.
And I'm Colin Bjork. Thanks for listening. If you like what you heard today, tell your rhetoric friends. You can also find more information about our podcast on our website, globalrhetorics.com. If you're on social media, you can follow us on Twitter at GlobalRet. That's at GlobalRhet. And we encourage you to share a link to this episode on your favorite rhetoric Facebook page. A transcription of this episode was done by Rebecca Ottman and is available on our website. Thanks to Dr. Annalie Bowie for taking the time for this interview. And in the interest of full disclosure, after the interview, Annalie offered to join our production team, so we have her to thank for our spectacular Global Rhetorics logo and many other designs. Thanks also to Professor Chris Rutten and the organizing committee for the 7th Rhetoric in Society conference held at the University of Ghent, Belgium. And a big shout out to the Global Rhetorics production team.
Annalie Bowie at the University of Johannesburg in South Africa.
Colin Bjork at Massey University in Aotearoa, New Zealand.
Jelte Olthof at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands.
Beck Weiss at the University of Queensland. Mianj in Brisbane, Australia.
Erik Bengtsson, Uppsala University, Sweden.
Joanna Kromick at Indiana University in the United States.
Jason McCulloch at Indiana University, Bloomington.
Rebecca Ottman, Indiana University, Bloomington.
And Jose Quintero at Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois. Our theme song is by my band, 1815. Check us out.